The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Werke, Judge Gaitis, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This panel of the court today has four cases on its agenda, two of which will be submitted with oral argument and two of which will be submitted without oral argument, solely on the briefs. And just for the sake of the audio record, today is May 12, 2021. The first case on today's oral argument calendar is In re the matter of the civil commitment of Jeffrey Thomas Penzamas, number A21-128. I believe counsel are familiar with our protocols. You should be able to see the time clock on a blue screen, and you may, Mr. Cascarano, you may begin whenever you're ready. Please introduce yourself and identify your client, and then you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Justices. My name is Craig Cascarano. I represent Mr. Penzamas in this matter, who is the appellant after being committed as a sexually dangerous person.
Mr. Cascarano, could I ask you to pause just for a minute? So could I ask maybe our technical assistance? I see that we are recording. Is that the Court of Appeals making the recording or is that someone else making the recording? Sue, could you? Okay, for some reason I haven't noticed that in the past and I apologize. Okay, Mr. Cascarano, I apologize for interrupting you, but perhaps you could begin again from the beginning, introducing yourself and your clients, and then without interruption, we'll let you begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, my name is Craig Cascarano. Good morning, Justices. I represent Mr. Jeffrey Penzamas in this matter. He is the appellant appealing a decision by the lower court committing him as a sexually dangerous person. I don't need to go through the three requirements that is necessary for the court to determine if Mr. Penzamas qualifies as a sexually dangerous person. For all intents and purposes, the state has to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he engaged in a course of harmful sexual conduct. Secondly, that there was a manifested sexual personality, other mental disorder, which we are not disputing, by the way. So the second portion of that seems to be irrelevant with regard to both my brief and my argument. And the third is perhaps the tipping point. And in my mind, the most important issue here is whether he is likely to engage in a harmful sexual conduct in the future. I think the state has outlined Mr. Penzamas's past in a detail much greater than I did, and probably did a better job than I did about his past. I don't think there's any question that Mr. Penzamas has an extensive past regarding sexual conduct. I think, however, that the court should look a little closer at that because his most serious offenses occurred in 1995. As I indicated in my brief, based upon all these prior sexual conduct, which in large part are non-contact offenses. I think perhaps before I go further, it is my view or our view that Mr. Penzamas is more of a non-contact sexual activity than contact. In other words, he's not jumping out of bushes, raping victims. He is more a person who draws sexual pleasure from voyeurism, masturbation, peeping Tom, those kinds of things. But there is an extensive history of that. There's no doubt about that.
Am I correct, Mr. Cascarano, that there are on eight occasions, he's engaged in conduct for which he was convicted of criminal sexual conduct?
He was. I think there are two offenses.
And just to be clear, I mean, obviously, by definition, I think all eight of those convictions, criminal sexual conduct always involves contact and touch, right?
They do. The statute provides the equitable presumption as to whether or not it's harm for sexual conduct if it's a first, second, or third or fourth degree criminal sexual conduct. I think in 95 or around 95, he had a second degree and a fourth degree. We don't dispute the fact that those, again, are within the statutory definition of a rebuttable presumption of harm for sexual conduct. But what I'm trying to get at in a roundabout way is this is kind of a curious matter in my mind, because we have a report that was issued by Dr. Kenny back in 2006 that indicates that, in her opinion, that his offense conduct did not rise to the level that he should be civilly committed. It's important to note that from 2006 to when this matter was tried, clearly he reoffended. There's no doubt about that. The vast majority of reoffenses again occurred with these non-contact offenses, except in 2017 on the state fair. So in a roundabout way, although we contend that the state has not shown harmful sexual conduct as a course of conduct, there clearly is a course of sexual conduct, but most of which is non-contact.
So, I just have a question. Does your argument rise and fall on the proposition that these non-contact offenses are not harmful? I mean, that seems to me to be sort of the gist of it. And if that is the case, is that a legal determination or is that a factual determination?
I don't think I could say it any better than that. I have spent a great deal of time going through all of this lengthy court record. Curiously, the court's order is 100 pages long. In my mind, Judge, the threshold issue here is whether or not these non-contact offenses rise to the level of harmful sexual conduct, and whether or not indeed the state can prove that to a clear and convincing nature, and should he be committed based upon the past non-contact offenses and of course the most current contact offenses. So I think you hit the nail on the head.
How do you distinguish then your client's behavior from the behavior that the court analyzed in Ray Stone? Stone had aggressive interactions with young girls who didn't necessarily lead to the sexual relations, but they said that this was also harmful sexual conduct. And if that's our guiding post, then how do you wrestle that with the fact you're saying harmful conduct is not necessarily manifested by the voyeurism and so on?
I think in the Stone case, Your Honor, his conduct was much more aggressive than Mr. Penzimus's.
Well, aggression again, as I remember, your client did go into homes and masturbate when he was inside of a home. You know, you're breaking into somebody's place. Surely that would be aggressive conduct.
I don't think there's any question that's aggressive conduct, but I think the benchmark is Dr. Kenning's report in 2006. And she said in 2006 that he would likely reoffend. He would likely reoffend in non-contact sexual offense. She even indicated that he might even, most of his contact offenses was just touching from the exterior. I think her assessment in 2006 really capsulizes what Mr. Penzimus's future conduct would be, which is exactly what happened from 2006 until when it was tried in 2018 and 19, there was all non-contact offenses except for the Minnesota State Fair issue in 2017. So she hit it right on the head. Now, I'm not unmindful of the fact that, of course, Dr. Kenning reviewed all the notes and saw Mr. Penn say he should be a dangerous person. But I think the threshold issue here is whether or not he's been on a vast, lengthy, mostly non-contact offenses. Clearly he had contact offenses, and I think it was in 95, as I indicated before, a second degree and a fourth degree, so I'm not disputing that, as to whether or not we're going to commit some, basically to a lifetime in prison. And I don't, I am animated about that simply because I'm not unmindful of the fact that this issue with regard to placing people in sex offender treatment has been litigated in federal court with Judge Frank, and whether it's appropriate to keep these people there. But they're going to be there for all intents and purposes. I think we could all conclude they're going to be there for maybe the rest of his life. And is it appropriate to commit someone to these this kind of treatment center for basically non-contact offenses except for the 2017 offense? And so the third issue, the third criteria, so to speak, is whether it's likely to engage in harmful sexual conduct, is whether or not he's highly likely to reoffend. And we have the six factors for Linehan that I've outlined in my brief. But the bottom line is it's our position that Mr. Penzimus is basically a non-contact sex offender, which I think Dr. Kenning found in 2006. And based upon that, he should not be committed. I have nothing further. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for any rebuttal.
It appears there are no further questions for you at this time. Our court protocol typically is to give appellants 5 minutes of rebuttal time, whether That's or fine, not Jeff. They've used all of their time previously. So you will have 5 minutes. Ms. Kesey, on behalf of respondent, you may introduce yourself, please, and begin.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel, Assistant Attorney General Angela Kesey, appearing today on behalf of Isanti County. As the appellant indicated, this is an appeal from an SDP commitment. I would note that in his brief, he references 253B, and that has all been recodified in 253D. So just so the court's aware of that, we have the 253D references in our brief. With respect to course of harmful sexual conduct, this is not a particularly close case. As the court noted, that Mr. Penzimus has at least eight offenses that meet the presumption under the statute for course of harmful sexual conduct. And in addition, I think the court found like 31 additional offenses by clear and convincing evidence that met the course of harmful sexual conduct standard. And this would be a different argument if we were looking at a guy who all he did his whole life was exposed himself or looked in windows. And even under the expert testimony at trial in this matter, there was even a distinction on those offenses made between these offenses where he's approaching people and he's masturbating in front of them and the harmfulness of that compared to some guy who's just, you know, 20 feet away, flashes his penis for an exposure or whatever. And the nature of, for example, even the voyeurism offenses, when like it's his nieces and they find out that he's been like repeatedly watching them when they're naked and he's developed these relationships with them. I mean, that's harmful sexual conduct. And that's all part of his course of harmful sexual conduct here, in addition to all the touch offenses. And so this is not a guy who, he had these violent rapes when he was 18, and then he never touched anyone again. And he did these random non-confrontative types of offenses. I mean, even on the voyeurism offenses, even not, you know, the son's girlfriend, he drilled a hole in the wall so he could get a better view of her in the shower. You know, she found out about these months of voyeurism offenses against her. That's harmful to her. There were these other victims that he would go into strangers' homes, invade their personal space. He would adjust blinds, adjust shades to make it easier for him to commit his offenses. And all of those, if you listen to the experts at trial, all of those offenses were part of his cycle. And not even just the experts, there was other evidence from, you know, other reports, pre-sentence investigations, other things in his history that showed that all of these, the masturbation, the exposure, this was all part of his wanting the sexual contact and engaging in the sexual contact. There's all kinds of evidence about these different touch victims, the young girl victims, where the one on the water ski, you know, he did have a touch offense against her, but he wanted more of a sexual relationship with her. And this was all kind of that cycle. And, you know, so even when you get to the most recent years, again, it's not like he just stopped touching people after the offenses in the 90s.
Can you remind me, please, of the record, I guess, previous to the State Fair incident in 2017, I think it was. What was the contact offense immediately previous to that, or the crimsex conviction immediately previous to that, if you happen to know? And of course,
Can I just take a quick look?
Well,
I have them outlined pretty much chronologically in my fact statement. So I think prior to that were the 2014, he had the touch offenses in the store where he was taking pictures up the skirt of the one woman, touched her inner thigh when he took the picture, and then the 12-year-old girl in the store where he knelt down next to her. I believe those were also touch offenses and were in the...
Was he convicted of a crimsex crime for those? For that kind
of sex related crimes, he was.
Well, I guess I'm asking whether
I think maybe those were those were interference with privacy convictions. I'm not sure. Let me just quick look. Yes, he was convicted of fifth degree criminal sexual conduct for those, or at least for one of those.
Judge Gaetis asked a question earlier about for the so called non contact offenses. Whether they're harmful, is that a question of law or is it a question of fact based upon the evidence in a particular case? What's your position on that?
Well, I think it's a mixed question of law and fact. I think you look at this guy's history of offenses in totality. I mean, this is not something that can be looked at in a vacuum, and you have to look at all of that and see does it meet the substantial risk of serious physical emotional harm under the statute. And both court-appointed examiners testified that it did, and the court found their testimony on that credible. And given the nature of his history with, like I said, you know, it's not like he has ever stopped. You know, his most recent offense, in fact, was this touch offense at the fair. So it's not like the touch offense has ever stopped with him. But yeah, I do think it's a mixed question of law and fact, and I think you look at his entire history. And as I said, I think while not all of the voyeurism and exhibitionism would qualify or raise to the level of harmful sexual conduct, I do think some of them, and Dr. Reitman, I believe, testified about this, and maybe Dr. Doherty too, but I think some of them, depending on, again, how much you're, you know, if you have a young girl sitting at a bus stop and you're approaching her and masturbating in front of her, or that is harmful. And again, if people are seeing somebody outside watching them, if they find out somebody's watching them, recording them, you know, that kind of thing can be part of the course of harmful sexual conduct. But we don't even need that here because he's got such an extensive course of harmful sexual conduct. He doesn't get like a bonus because he did so much harmful sexual conduct. I mean, he's got that if you just look at the touch offenses. He's got, of course, of harmful sexual conduct. And he's got two violent rapes. That alone would count for course of harmful sexual conduct. I realize those are far back in his history, but as impulsive as he is, you don't know what he's going to choose to do next when he gets into his cycle. Is he going to go to the state fair and masturbate and grab somebody sexually? Is he going to grab, you know, some young girl that he knows sexually? You know, so that's the problem, is this course of harmful sexual conduct, is all of his conduct kind of wrapped together in his history.
I have a question about the second issue, that he's highly likely to reoffend, is one way it's stated. So what does the law require? Highly likely to do what exactly? And I guess keeping this distinction in mind between contact offenses and non-contact offenses, does the law require the petitioner, that's your client, to prove that he would engage in contact offenses or just any of those offenses?
Any harmful, it's highly likely to engage in harmful sexual conduct in the future. So any of the offenses that would fit into the harmful sexual, that would be harmful sexual conduct, he would have to be highly likely to do that.
So in other words, I mean, you're saying that the SDP statute allows someone to be committed if they're highly likely to engage in voyeurism or exhibitionism, et cetera.
Well, if the type of voyeurism or exhibitionism that would rise to course of harmful sexual conduct,
that would be harmful.
As I said.
Right. But I mean, in the client's, I mean, the witness's testimony was that the non-contact offenses were harmful or were substantially likely to be harmful, I think. So, but I guess, is there any case law in which an appellate court has approved of a commitment based on evidence that somebody's highly likely to engage in non-contact offenses, such as window peeping, exhibitionism, and so on?
Kirkoff is the one I think that talks about it out of Chisago County, KIRCKOF, but I'm just right now trying to remember what the case was. That was a guy who was just an exposer, but I just don't think in this case, with how the evidence was in this case, we don't need to prove that just engaging in exposure or window peeping is enough, because this guy also, his most recent offense was a touch offense. So I don't, you know.
Well, that was my next question.
That's necessary.
I guess that was my next question. Did the witnesses in this case testify that he was highly likely to engage in criminal sexual conduct? In other words, a touch offense, the type of criminal offense that we're more familiar with as an underlying basis for a civil commitment as SDP?
Yes, they testify that he's highly likely to engage in harmful sexual conduct.
Not just harmful sexual conduct, but touch related or harmful sexual conduct of the type that satisfies the elements of criminal sexual conduct.
You know, what the standard is harmful sexual conduct. So, but they did focus on, yes, they did testify that he's highly likely to engage in the touch conduct. Again, as part of his cycle, they believe that he's highly likely to engage in the criminal sexual conduct, the touch offenses. But I'm just saying, part of his whole cycle includes these other, his offenses range from, the low to the violent rapes. So he's done it all against all kinds of victims, stranger victims, known victims, child victims, adult victims. Like I said, I don't think this guy gets a bonus. I mean, this all, those things, the experts testified, that all increases his risk. The fact that he is so, hypersexual, he has such a broad range of sexual conduct that he will engage in when he's under stress, when he's in the community. And that was all supported. There are opinions that he's highly likely to engage in harmful sexual conduct in the future. You know, that was supported not only by the expert testimony, it was a combination of the actuarial supported that, the dynamic factors supported that. And the one factor here that was protective is his recent completion of treatment. But in the past, he has repeatedly reoffended during treatment. He's reoffended while on supervision repeatedly. And one of the big concerns here is that this guy is no longer on any supervision. His supervision ended earlier this year. So this is a guy who's untested in the community, and he has shown no ability. His last offense was committed, I think, within weeks of his release, and he was on supervised release. So they both supported that he's highly likely to reoffend sexually.
And just to be clear, I mean, my questions are designed to, I mean, that to say reoffend is not as specific as, I mean, I guess the question is reoffend how? Reoffend by committing criminal sexual conduct, or reoffend by committing an offense that's, I think, deemed by the law less serious than criminal sexual conduct because it doesn't involve physical contact. But, and I'm just, you know, from reading the district court's order, it often does not specify. It uses the phrase, like you just said, highly likely to reoffend, but that, and I'm just wondering whether there's a distinction between highly likely to reoffend by engaging in a crim sex crime versus a lesser crime.
Well, and yeah, the nomenclature is course of harmful sexual conduct. So that's kind of what we look at and what the experts look at and what we argue about is it going to be a course of harmful sexual conduct? So that's the kind of thing that they testified about, but they did testify. I mean, part of his course are the touch offenses. So they did testify that he was highly likely to commit additional touch offenses in the future. My recollection is not that they limited it to he's highly likely to do these other things. And in fact, even this business with Dr. Kenning's 2006 report, I mean, she looked at this case again in 2019 after he committed a bunch more offenses between 2006 and 2019. So they rely on this report, you know, saying she doesn't support commitment. Well, she then did support commitment the next time she looked at it after he reoffended repeatedly. So, and including with touch offenses. So nobody relied, I mean, as far as supporting the commitment, the reliance was on the more recent report. The report that even the examiners looked at or reviewed would be her most recent pre-petition report was what they, what Dr. Doherty anyway mentions in his report. But so my understanding is that the evidence supports and their testimony was that he would engage in a course of harmful sexual conduct in the future, that he was highly likely to do that. And that includes touch offenses, if that makes sense. It's just hard because this doesn't happen in a vacuum. This guy's got all kinds of different offenses, more extreme, less extreme, but he's been completely out of control when he's been in the community.
Your time has expired, and okay. It appears there are.
May I ask one additional question?
Yes, Judge Gaitis, go ahead.
I just want to make sure that I understand what your position is. Are you arguing that we don't have to conclude that the harmful future conduct necessarily will involve touch offenses? Your argument is that given the specific non-touch offenses that were committed, those alone and the potential for those type of offenses in the future are sufficient. Is that what your argument is?
Well, what I'm saying is the evidence was that he was highly likely to engage in a course of harmful sexual conduct that may include those non-touch offenses, but it would... The course of harmful sexual conduct in this case, the stronger part of it is the touch offenses, and that he's also highly likely to engage in touch offenses because he gets in this cycle and he engages in touch offenses too. So I'm not saying that. I mean, the evidence was he was highly likely to engage in a course of harmful sexual conduct in the future. His course includes such offenses and these other offenses. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kiza. Mr. Cascarano, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
I think, Judge, I will subscribe to the theory of never say anything that doesn't acknowledge to silence, and therefore I will not have any rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay. Unless, let me just check and see if either of the other judges has any questions for you. It appears not. So thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is deemed submitted. The second case on our agenda today is scheduled for 10 minutes after 10. We will have a short recess until then, and then we will take the second case. Thank you.
Thank you.